So, this is a very confusing point. I think that people are struggling with. This reality right now is our consensual reality. So, we all know that this is a notebook, or binder. And we know that this color is white. That's because we all agree on that. And quite frankly, it takes a lot of training to learn that. In fact, our brain gets about 1 billion bits of information every second. And we use about 3% of that to create this consensual reality. So we reach into the data stream and we pull out a very small percentage to create this reality. If you doubt that what I'm saying is true, we have something we call the blind spot. And the blind spot is where all our retinal nerves bundle together to go back to the brain. So we actually have a tiny little spot that we can't see, that there's no retinal nerves cells to see. Well, why don't you see your blind spot? Well, because your brain is seamlessly filling in the background at all times. It doesn't matter how fast you move. You can move your head as fast as you want. Your brain seamlessly fills it in. Furthermore, the primary sensory stream that you all, and me too, that we think of as real, interestingly enough, is augmented prior to conscious thought at about 30% of memory and what are called higher cortical functions. So what we think is real, our perceptions of reality, really about 30% come from our own concepts of what reality should be. And this makes life very efficient. For example, most of your faces I don't recognize. I don't know who you guys are, and an hour from now, if you came up to me, I wouldn't recognize you. But Martin comes up to me an hour from now, I will instantly recognize him. Is that because I've memorized every single aspect of his face? Absolutely not. Research has shown that I actually process only a tiny portion of his face. And then I put it into what's they call face space. And it's a theoretical domain in the brain that stores what familiar faces look like. And so it just makes this life that much easier. It makes it easier for us to navigate this life. But we cling to this version of reality very intensely. So what happens when we lose all our perceptual input? You can see exactly what happens. Almost every one of these children describe a stage in which they're just bewildered by a maze of sensory information and colors. Remember that slide I told you about that everything went black, and then it's just all these colors. And then they struggle to make sense of it. This young man, never hearing of a near-death experience before, told me that he was in a noodle. Now he's thinking about it. Well, wait a minute. Noodles don't have rainbows in them. It must have been a tunnel. And again, that's why I feel very privileged to have been able to interview these children and talk to them for the first time. Because he never referred to the noodle again. You know, once he learned, so that's the process of spiritual reality becoming then a consensual reality. The issue is not, are they inventing their experience? The issue is being humble enough to understand that we invent this experience. That this experience is only a small perception of what we constantly see. I'll give you another quick example, and then I'll tell you about Mr. Smirker here. There's something called cortical blindness. Very interesting phenomenon that proves this point. When our visual input comes into the eye, it's then processed about 8 times an area in the back of the brain called the occipital lobe. Now, I haven't heard anybody claim that this is a hallucination because I have a huge hunk of my brain that's dedicated to creating this visual image. But as some of you are aware, and I'll share with you in a moment, for some reason, because we have a spiritual generating area of the brain, people say, aha, it was just in the brain. That seems a little bit of a stretch. But anyway, we do have a visual reality perceptual creator area in the brain, and it's back here. What happens if the flow of information from the eye to the back of the brain is disrupted? We get a phenomenon known as cortical blindness. Patients can't see. And yet, if you ask them to walk up and down these stairs and to take a seat, they can do it. So clearly, information is processed on the perceptual level, or before the perceptual level. And this is not neuroscientific heresy. It's just a neuroscientific fact that most people seem unaware of. But in fact, the man who developed the fMRI, and one of the most brilliant neurocognitive researchers, said that it's clear to him that perception begins before information hits the brain. And that's just a fancy way of saying that consciousness exists outside of our brain. And that the brain then is some sort of a filter, is some sort of a device that we use to then communicate and interact with each other. And that certainly matches the information I learned from near-death experiences. That when the brain is taken away, they describe a greater sense of reality. They describe more colors. Colors I've never seen before is a very common comment. So this goes back to the question that Arvin Gibson raised at the beginning. This is Michael Shermer. He's a very big proponent of that the near-death experience is really just a lot of random firing of neurons in the brain, and then our left mind imposes order on it, just like we would with the stars. You know, that so that we look out into the heavens, and human beings are myth makers, and so we want to tell stories, and we create constellations. Or is the other? Is there really something hidden that we ordinarily can't see? And that's what I'm suggesting, that near-death research supports. So are they real? And I spent about 25 years looking into this. My audience is grieving parents. And grieving parents do not want to be condescended to. And grieving parents do not want to be told they're there. If it makes you feel better, believe it. They want to know my honest opinion. And the grieving parents that I regularly work with, if I came to the conclusion, sorry, I've looked into it to my best of my ability, and it is just a bunch of hallucinations from your brain, and it is just your grief that's creating these visions, the grieving parents I know would accept that. However, there's some indisputable facts, scientific facts. Near-death experiences are the dying experience, regardless of what interpretation you want to put on. I don't care what you call them. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not any of that kind of stuff. They're the dying experience. They happen in dying, dysfunctional, and frankly, dead brains, and they happen to people who die alert and conscious without medications. So any theory of near-death experiences has to explain how that can happen. If we're going to say they're all a bunch of hallucinations of the dying brain, well, how come people that die fully conscious have them? Secondly, about 30% of the human brain is dedicated to allowing us to have these experiences. That's a huge part of the human brain. I realize that many people say, oh, aha, see, that proves it just in the brain. Well, we have a huge area of the brain that creates, like I said, the visual images. I don't hear people making that same argument. Thirdly, we learn lessons of love when we die, and they perceive a timeless, spaceless, informational domain that most children just say, was God. That's why I like talking to kids. They don't use terms like that. We see other realities when we die. The typical person or child that has a near-death experience, I'll say to them, well, how long was it? They'll say, it could have been a second or it could have been my whole life. They don't perceive time as part of the experience. Well, guess what? Science tells us that the nature of reality is a timeless, spaceless, informational domain. In fact, that has been the reigning theory of the nature of reality for the last 100 years. 100 years, science has been saying that matter, reality isn't this sort of billiard ball theory of matter, etc., but that it's far more complex than that. And that time doesn't seem to matter. And that space doesn't matter. And the types of theories, the types of experiments that they do are so simple. I'm going to share one with you. Because I want you to really understand this. When I read the paper and stuff like that, entanglement and stuff like that, does anybody here know what entanglement really means? See? That's my point. Okay, guess what? Here's what entanglement means. They take a metal and they heat it really hot. It's super hot. And it emits a light, a burst of light. They take that light and they send it through Polaroid filters, sunglasses, so that it bends. And then they take a prism. And they divide it. So now that one beam of light has become two beams of light. Okay? And then they take Polaroid sunglasses again. They don't really take Polaroid sunglasses. They take the $1 million equivalent of Polaroid sunglasses. And they bend the light again. But they just bend one of the beams. So they turn one of the beams green. And guess what? the other being instantly turns, I don't know the actual color, but
red.
Instantly. And then they do it again. They bend it back from red to green. The other beam instantly changes to the other color. That's what they mean by entanglement. That somehow those protons, that beam of light that was born of the single event, well, we're all born of the single event of the Big Bang, they say, so we're all entangled, let's face it. By their definition, by the science definition of entanglement, the beam of light is born by that event of heating up a piece of metal so that a pulse of light comes out of it. It's forever entangled. And that's what they mean by entanglement. That what they do, they split it in two, and what they do to the one beam, instantly, beyond the speed of light, so no information can be transferred, instantly, the other beam changes color. And they have done this as far out as miles. You know, they bent their beam of light, and they've let they've let it go out miles and miles and miles. So that's what entanglement is. So these are pretty simple experiments that they do. These are the types of experiments that tell them that this is an interconnected universe. Alrighty, well, what about the other reality? Okay, so they've added up all the mass of the universe, all the billiard balls of the universe, and they've added them all up. And guess what? It's only about a third as much as it should be. Then they figured out what all the subatomic particles in the universe should be. And in this reality, there's 12 basic subatomic particles. But in theory, there's 36 or something like that. But nevertheless, the point is that a whole bunch of subatomic particles are missing, and most of the mass is missing. So where is it? Their theory is it's right here. Their theory is it's actually right here, but we can't see it. So they call it dark matter. Not dark because it's evil, but dark because we can't see it. And presumably, in theory, this dark matter is made of the missing subatomic particles. Well, so if consciousness evolved in this third of reality, well, why wouldn't consciousness have evolved in those other two-thirds of reality that we can't see? But that's a speculation on my part, obviously. But nevertheless, there are other realities to see. So the second lesson is, we're going to go over the brain here real quick. Robert Penfield, over 50 years ago, stimulated areas of the brain. When he got to what's called the hippocampus in the right temporal lobe, patients said things like, "Oh God, I've left my body." We now know, with more sophisticated modern studies, this is the study of meditators, that when they go into profound meditation and they think that they're interacting with God, this area of the brain in the back turns off. That's the area that's the sense of self that is responsible for integrating the perceptual stream. So just like my patients, when they die, they lose their perceptual stream. And then there's increased areas in the front part of the lower brain, and ultimately there's an area of the part of the brain right here that starts working and ultimately links us with spiritual realities. This is a theory that I developed about 20 years ago. That's one magazine cover's sort of conceptualization of it. And Scientific American, the almost identical picture, this is from last year. And this is over the issue of could memories be stored outside of the brain. Scientific American is pointing out that we can download memories from the brain now. Obviously, we can download them and look through the same connected areas. Obviously, we can upload them. So I'm not going to go. Memories can be stored out of the brain. And in fact, we do create this reality. Okay, so what am I saying? I'm saying there's plenty of room for angels in the world. Two-thirds of the mass of the world is missing. Most of the subatomic particles are missing. Nobel Prize theorists who looked at the issue of how did life develop on this planet tell us stuff like RNA couldn't have just spontaneously evolved, that there must have been some sort of conscious process for it. That's Christian De Dove, Nobel Prize winner, of figuring out how RNA and proteins evolved out of the primal soup. He calls it vital dust. He says the only explanation is that there's vital dust. Okay, these students are given the task of bouncing a ball. and they're asked to count how many times they bounce the ball and pass it. Does everybody see the figure in the middle up there? One half of those students do not see that man in a gorilla suit. That's correct. They don't. Because remember, we're only grabbing 3% of the perceptual stream and creating this reality. What, could they be fighting among each other? Well, what about the ones that did see it? They'll say, okay, well, there really was a man in a gorilla suit. No, you guys are crazy. There's no man in a gorilla suit. We didn't see the man in a gorilla suit. You know, before you know it, they'll be starting their own little cults and having gorilla suit man wars and, you know, trying to kill each other over the issue, probably. But nevertheless, when I show this to audiences without cueing the audience, about one third of the audience members do not see it either. So, to a great extent, we see what we think we're supposed to see. So, if that's happening, well, if that's happening, there's plenty of room to be seeing angels. And what about this physics theory that life is the nature of reality, is that there's no time and there's no space and all that stuff? Isn't that just a mathematical model that people argue? They say, wait, that's just a mathematical model. That's not real. This is real. This is the real reality. Well, we might miss the man in the gorilla suit, but nevertheless, still real. Nobody's actually been to this timeless, spaceless domain, have they?
The near-death experience is so profound that it often breaks down previous conceptions of reality, religion, and God.
Who had all of the intelligence, all of the life, all of the love you can imagine. That when I told the story first at the Heinz Group, you know, a few years ago here in Greenland, that one of the neat people there said, well, Chuck, that's all very interesting, but what did you learn after that? And I came out with something that I don't hesitate to repeat a lot. And it comes on like, life is love, is God. And if you try to twist it around or underscore any part of it, you're not making it better. That is the solid core reality of things. And death, you know, you heard me say on one of the other tapes, death itself is a body problem.
Clearly this is one man who believes he's been to the all-informational, timeless, spaceless domain. No question about it.
I don't know how, what happened next happened. I don't know if I was called back. I just know that after being in that light, being the light, I started to come down. Like head first through a tunnel, a very dark tunnel. And I was screaming. I felt like I was screaming. And everything I knew there, it's like going past me in reverse speed. All the words in the universe, everything I had heard, everything I knew, all the knowledge I had was gone backwards. I was coming down through it, and it was like horrifying. It was a horrifying experience coming back down. And I didn't want to come back down. I wanted to be back there. And then I woke up, and I was in the recovery room, and my husband was holding the baby that was born at the bottom of the bed, and I didn't know what happened. My first conscious thought was, who was born here? I felt like I was the one who was born.
That's a beautiful description of her transition from the all-informational billion bits a second reality, which, by the way, is, again, not controversial. I've really tried in this lecture to tell you what is my own speculations. You've got to make up your own minds. But this is not controversial. It's well documented. I mean, the idea of memory being outside the brain, sure. 99.999% of neuroscientists are not going to buy that one. If you ask them where memory is, they're not going to be able to tell you. But human beings have two streams of consciousness as well known. Well documented. So she's describing the transition from the billion bit a second, informational reality that, let's face it, most people call God. Isn't that what people say? They always say God's, you know, God's in us. God's in each one of us. God's always talking to us, but the left brain chatter keeps us from hearing it. And that's the kind of stuff I hear from religious thinkers and stuff. And she's describing the transition back to the 3% that is this reality. I forgot to tell you, I should have told you at the beginning, she nearly died giving birth. So I love that ending. And yes, there are other realities to see. But most of the mass of the universe is missing. Again, not controversial. Supposedly, life on this Earth evolved out of the primal soup. In no way am I disputing Darwin's theory of evolution. That's a well-established fact. No doubt about it. However, we're not talking about that type of evolution. We're not talking about the evolvement of species to specific niches by environmental and pressures. They're going to live or they're going to die, etc. We're talking about what happened in the beginning when the first celled organisms formed. They came together as RNA and DNA, and they formed into cells. Everyone, every mainstream thoughtful scientist who looks at that issue says the odds of that happening are 1 billion to 1. Alrighty, there's nothing wrong with that. Most of those scientists say, yeah, it was 1 billion to 1. Thank God it happened. They don't say, thank God it happened. I guess they say, cool, it happened. It's 1 billion to 1. But nevertheless, that leaves a gap for the rest of us to say, hey, wait a minute. Maybe they're like Christian Deneuve, who is a Nobel Prize winner, pretty smart guy. And he says, no, it didn't just happen by accident, that there is a conscious imperative. It seemed to be they're coming together as in some sort of mysterious plan. Mysterious plan. What am I talking about? Just to be blunt about it, I'm talking about math. That's the mysterious glue. But people don't make that jump. I have many friends, chaos mathematicians, etc., and they tell us that math is. We're talking about, do we impose our order on the chaos, or is there hidden order in chaos? Well, the math of life says there's hidden order in chaos. There's order in the chaotic beating of the human heart. There's order in the coastlines of the great continents. There's order in the way plants grow. All of those things grow according to mathematical formulas. Where did those formulas come from? Whose mind? Chaos mathematicians, you know, see, each discipline of science has its own kind of little quirks. Chaos mathematicians have no trouble saying we're doing the mathematics of God. They don't. So I just want to be clear on when we're talking about this kind of stuff. Informational theorists, they never use the word God, but they say information is the underlying pattern of reality. That one issue that's got to be addressed is we have to all start talking the same language. My spirituality and your spirituality and another person's informational theory and a third person's mathematical model of the universe, we're all talking about the same thing. Just for fun, I went to friends of religious thinkers. And they did stuff like, they pulled out of all the religious scriptures that God is knowledge, God is all knowledge. Mormon Bible is blow for blow, very strikingly similar to the current scientific understandings. Arvin Gibson wrote a great book about that. If you all want to read it, it's called The Fingerprints of God. Okay, I'm not a clinician, not really interested in all this stuff. I'm really interested in this issue of that you're crazy to see God. That actually is not true. Numerous studies have documented that using your right temporal lobe to see angels is actually good for you. Unfortunately, the DSM-IV, which the American Psychiatric Association uses as its Bible, unfortunately categorizes dissociative and spiritual experiences as pathological. But the literature does not back that up. People who have spiritual experiences have a better sense of mental health, they live longer. And I'm not talking about, obviously, people that have religious practices that don't involve drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes, they're going to live longer than everyone else. That's not because they believe in God. I'm talking about when those factors are sorted out and removed. It's good for you to use your right temporal lobe. It's a source of spirituality and wisdom. It's a source of the transformation of the near-death experience. It facilitates intuition and decision making. Law enforcement use intuition, making life and death situations, and frequently have out of body experiences facilitating them. They don't have a problem with this because they're using it to save somebody's life or often their own life. So people that actually use this kind of information on a regular basis are not having problems with it, understanding that it's actually good for you to do that. When I studied people that had near-death experiences as children, here's the big secret. Be nice. See the light everywhere. Know that your life is meaningful. Give of yourself to the community. You know, those are the kinds of things that we found that people who had near-death experiences did more than our control subjects. And we used as a control highly religious people. And interestingly enough, people that had near-death experiences gave more money to charity, saw themselves as part of an interconnected life. And they felt they were important. And this, to me, is the most interesting and most important aspect of all of this. I interviewed this one, a young man, and he's part of our original study, and now he's about 23. Now he thinks he's important, and he's better than everybody else, and he probably thinks he's going to have a cure for cancer or whatever. And you know, these are all the thoughts that are going through my mind. And so I said, okay, I'll bite. You know, why are you so important? He said, I'm important because of my job. Oh, okay, so you have a special job. Cool. You know, so what's important about that? He got mad at me. He said, wait a minute, I already filled out your questionnaire. You know what my job is. I run a little construction company. I hire four of my friends from high school. Those numbnuts could never get a job if it weren't for me. You know, that's what he learned. He learned he was sent back from heaven to run a small construction company that did fairly minor household repairs and jobs in the community, and he hired four of his friends from high school. And yet that was so important and meaningful to him. His life was important. That's a beautiful thing. Spiritual experiences, they come a lot of different ways. And just be aware of that. Maybe you won't see an angel. Maybe you'll have another. But I just want to point out that intuition and spiritual visions are right-brained, and you can tell the difference between them and anxieties, which is what I think a lot of people are worried about. They're worried about, well, I'm anxiety-driven, I'm afraid of dying, so I'm just sort of making all this up. Spiritual intuitions are devoid of, they don't have analysis and judgment to them, and they're surprising. They're odd. They're idiosyncratic. If you remember that young man, I saw a bumblebee, and I knew it liked me because it gave me some bread. That's very odd. That just has the ring of a real experience. Ultimately, though, as a scientific statement, I want to share with you, to me, this reality is for a purpose. That we're here for a reason. That's why we have this limited, created reality. So that our consciousness can interact with each other. It's about learning lessons of love. Virtually everybody that has a near-death experience says that. And I want to share this last video with you because it's not just about learning lessons of love. It's learning to accept love. To accept this grace that is given to us. And before I share this video, I'll tell you a story. There's a woman up the street from me, and her son died in a horrible motorcycle accident. And what? And her only son. That's the parent's nightmare. And she has a flip phone. And she opened up her flip phone one day, and her son's picture was embedded in the flip phone, picture portion of the phone. But it wasn't from the phone. It wasn't a picture that was in the phone's memory. It wasn't part of the wallpaper. She wasn't able to get that off of the screen to, like, email to somebody. It was actually embedded in the picture. She's not accepted this as a true miracle. This has become extremely troubling to her. She takes it to people and she says, is this really true? Couldn't this just have happened on accident? She's not able to accept what would seemingly be obvious, that her son has somehow manipulated this very manipulable reality. And it is. This very manipulable reality. And somehow put his face on her phone. She's not able to accept this gift of love. That's a lot of what my obligation is. If I can contribute in some small way to somebody saying, yes, it is true. Yes, it is true. There's no reason that we shouldn't believe that these experiences are real. They're as real as math. They're as real as love.
The near-death eyewitnesses report that their angels actually gave them a choice of whether to go with them or not. A dramatic example of this was the case of Dr. Ron Kennedy, a San Francisco physician who survived a brutal knife attack in which he was stabbed more than 13 times. Dr. Kennedy was returning home from giving a lecture overseas. to find his friend and house sitter sitting on the stairs in a psychotic state.
I saw sitting on the stairs, there's my friend Abdul, who had been house-sitting for me, you know, during that week I was gone. And I noticed that he was beating sweat across his brow. And I said, How are you? Well, at that moment in time, he screamed at the top of his lungs incredibly loud. And I hadn't noticed that he had a steel tennis racket in his right hand. And then there's a break in my memory, and I don't remember anything until, I guess a few moments later, waking up on the floor. And then I noticed that he was swinging a, well, what turned out to be a dagger. And it appeared to me that I really didn't have a chance, that he had gained the upper hand, and that I was going to die. And as I looked over his shoulder, I could see a kind of hallway. And you know, I don't have a hallway in that part of my house. And at that moment, time stopped. Where the hallway had been, there appeared a light. And then it began to take on the characteristics of a kind of personality. And then it gave me a question. And it shot a question. I have to say it this way. It shot a question into me, like an arrow into my chest, not with words, but with just the heart of the thought itself. And the question was, will you come now or later? And I wanted to know, what might be next. And on the other hand, I could see aspects of my life which were just clearly unfinished. I had a 3-year-old son at that time. I was full of his spirit. It was his presence which really made the decision. I'm not leaving this now. I'm not finished. And so I gave the answer back by, directly as the question was given to me. I stayed.
It was 10 years before Dr. Kennedy was able to speak about his near-death experience and to then be able to understand what he had seen and felt.
After this, it occurred to me that the love from this life was so overwhelming that this life must have something to do about learning to love like that. Learning to love like that, or learning, perhaps even more to the point, learning to be loved like that. To actually experience the love that people have for us.
Ron's story has been used by counselors to give comfort to families of murder victims who feared their loved ones died alone and in pain.
This light could appear to me in these circumstances. I was being murdered, and yet I was not going to die alone. That was plain. And I was going to die in a sea of enormous love. And if I had anything to say to people, I guess it would be, those people you love who have died, maybe in the most extreme circumstances. If my experience is any indication, those people did not die alone, as you would fear that they did. They died with great love around them.
When I was a medical student, we had a patient die at age 3, and I didn't want to practice medicine anymore. I thought it was wrong, and I couldn't handle it. The patient would die at 3 of a genetic disease. It seemed wrong. And my attending, Frank Oski, who's easily the dean of American pediatricians, attending Johns Hopkins, which is hardly a spiritual institution, told us that the same thing happened to him when he was a medical student. And he said that a woman in white appeared at the foot of his bed. And that woman in white said to him that we're here to learn lessons of love. And these lessons can be extremely painful. And sometimes the only way to learn them is to die at age 3 of a genetic disease. Or to have a child that dies at age 3 of a genetic disease. And I was a kid then, and we thought he was full of it. And we rolled our eyes and didn't know what he was talking about. And Frank Oski, this is exactly what he said to me. He said, I don't ask that you believe that this happened to me. He said, I wouldn't believe it if someone else told me. He said, I only ask that you be open to the ordinary miracles of everyday life. And that is, in fact, what I've learned from studying near-death experiences. These experiences are real in the sense that you can trust the information that you get from them. And I've, in my own personal life, I can tell you, this is my baby here, and my baby would not be alive if I hadn't learned how to trust my own spiritual intuition. Thank you very much. And I'm happy to answer questions. The question is, how can people survive brain death of 4 or 5 minutes? We studied children. These children, it's not unusual to children to be brain dead for 20, 30, 40 minutes and still resuscitate. Many of these are cold water drownings. Children die often in that means, so that seems to have a protective effect. However, you asked me a question, and I'm just going to tweak your brain a bit with the answer. Theoretical physicists tell us that there is no future, that the future is just unlimited possibility and probability. Seriously, that's what they say. They say that if everybody in this room did not look at this lectern, that this lectern would dissolve into probability. And that when we look again, it would be changed. The size might be 10 to the minus 13 centimeters different, because it's not going to change very much, because the probability is such. I've thought a lot about your question. When we're talking about the complexities of what is brain death, I think that there's a greater expanded sense of probability. I've seen patients who've died, and yet their brains are perfectly functional. I've seen patients who, in despair, have said to me, I'm going to die now, and they turned their face to the wall, and they were clearly dead, and yet their brains were still functioning. And I think that at this indeterminate point between life and death, I think there's far more probability than we think. And there is an opportunity. And I think that there's an extended period of time until finally every single cell has ceased its activity and there's no chance whatsoever of life coming back. I'm sure there must be a final cutoff point. I've never heard of anybody been dead for a day and coming back, or weeks, or I guess the historical Jesus Christ might be different, but I do think that there's a lot of wiggle room in this area of what is death. Sure, that love maybe can provide enough energy to jumpstart and revive those dying cells. I'll put it to you a different way. Your question is a challenging one. We could spend a day, and if you want to see a bunch of neuroscientists gouging each other's eyes out, you could ask them the same question. The best answer I can give you is I don't find it outside the realm of scientific possibility that these brains can be dead 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and yet still come back to life. I don't find that a scientific impossibility.
If we have a loved one who is in a medically induced coma or coma or otherwise unconscious, what is your opinion as to when we talk with them?
Absolutely.
Can they hear us?
Yes. I think that there's no question about it. The answer is just yes. I would talk to any comatose patient as if they were fully awake and conscious. And even more than that, there are so many cases of people that say, when I was in the dying process, I heard what they were saying in the waiting room. I have a child who was a picture I didn't put up there. He says that when he nearly died, he could see his mother and grandfather hugging in the waiting room. They have an expanded sense of consciousness and awareness. I think I indicated to you earlier about that good friend of mine, that he actually made a little study of. He would turn the heart monitor so he couldn't see it. He'd whisper in his dad's ear, I love you. And, ask the nurse to document changes. But anecdotally, any experienced physician, any experienced intensive care unit nurse, even infant intensive care unit nurses, we know that an infant will hang on and hang on and hang on. You can't believe they're still alive, and you don't even know what to do anymore. I mean, you're just pumping them full of drugs, and they still seem to be living. And then their parents will come, and boom, they die. Just like that. And that happens frequently. That's not an uncommon occurrence. So I would have those people in your thought all the time.
How
Hi, you said something about if it weren't for you, your daughter wouldn't be here.
Yes.
Can you tell us what happened?
When my daughter was born, she was a water delivery. My wife wanted to deliver her in, you know, tub of water. She was thought to be a low-risk delivery, so it wasn't in a facility that could resuscitate babies. My wife has a very high tolerance for pain, so the midwife misinterpreted her contractions. And my midwife had come in and said, "How are you doing?" My wife said, "I'm not really having any pain, everything's fine." And so the midwife, the birthing center is at the top of one tower of St. Joseph's Hospital in Tacoma. And so she went all the way down into the top of another tower. And then after she left, my daughter was born. Well, her head was. My wife delivered the baby's head. And she's the only biological child I have. And I was 52. I was filled with a lot of anxiety and fear. And this was a horrible moment for me. Also, my baby, she was looking up at me through the water, and her face is all blue, it's all squished and weird looking, and she was staring at me. It was a horrible experience. I cannot tell you how horrible it was. And of course, I know as a physician, she's blue because it's venous blood. Yeah, so, but nevertheless, it was horrifying. Even though I'm a pediatrician, I've done so much emergency work and did so much airlift work, I've delivered hundreds of babies at that point. So I determined I would just go ahead and deliver her. And the nurse also thought that I should deliver her because we were concerned that her head was already delivered. She could break her shoulders if my wife went into further labor. So the nurse went ahead and checked her for a cord around her neck to make sure that there was no cord. And she signaled to me that there was no cord, and she indicated that I should go ahead and deliver my daughter. And plus, I'm kind of that kind of person. In fact, my thought was, this is meant to be. What a cool thing. I'm going to deliver my baby. And the midwife is off from the other tower. Wow, this is so cool. So that was my thought. And I was filled with pride. I'd be blunt with you, I was. So as I went to deliver her, hands grabbed my body. And they grabbed my arms. I thought there was a bird on my shoulder, a small bird. I thought this was wrong, you know, crazy, or I didn't know what it was. So I then was like, I just thought this was my anxiety or something. So I went towards, you know, because my wife was in the tub and my daughter's looking up at me. So I tried again. And just everything I've shared with you happened to me. Time, it was like a checklist in my mind. I want to share this with you so much that if this ever happens to you, because it was just, I just went through a mental checklist in my mind. Wait a minute, this is vividly real. These hands feel real. Wait a minute, time has stopped. It was absolute, it was like time stopped. Wait a minute, this is absurd. This is odd. I would never have, in my anxiety or fear or pride, thought there was a bird on my shoulder, like a small falcon, and it had every single element. And I knew at that moment that the whole reason I'd gone to medical school, and the whole reason I did my near-death research and written books, was for that moment. It was crystal clear to me. And as soon as I thought that, I said, this is that moment of total knowledge, of total insight. And then this bird said to these, you know, now I think of them as angels, but at the time I just thought of them as hands. And the bird said to the hands, "I wonder what he'll do." And it was so cold and dispassionate. And it just clearly indicated to me, it's okay if he makes the wrong decision and his daughter is born brain dead. Seriously, that's what I heard. It's okay. And the voice didn't tell me which decision to make. And then it's just, all I can tell you is, because I'm very much this kind of a person, and doing the kind of work that I did for so many years, you work that way. The ABCs of resuscitation. And I just ticked it off. This is odd. This is real. This is not something I would anticipate. Obviously, this bird is giving me a message that's devoid of analysis or judgment. There was no judgment or analysis in this bird's voice. This bird was almost interested. I wonder what he'll do. Having a brain-dead child is very interesting. And then I knew it. I just knew I was not to deliver my baby. And so I didn't. And the nurse then was looking at me and looking at me. And the birthing room records were that we stood there for 8 minutes. So that's how long this lasted. And my wife looked at me, and my wife didn't have a contraction for 8 minutes after delivering the head. And the nurse kept looking at me, you know, angry. What's wrong with you? Have you frozen? And that's the other thing, is that all the feelings I were having was against. That helped me to sort it out too. I knew I was doing the right thing because it was counterintuitive. The nurse was clearly giving me the impression, what, are you scared? What, now you're frozen because you're choking? You know, now's the time, and you've choked. You can't deliver your own baby. And none of that meant anything to me. Because I said, okay, that's the fear and anxiety part. Of course, that's the fear and anxiety. That's, and the other part is the non-judgment analysis part. It was like everything I had done was like a nice little list. I couldn't have asked for anything more. And then the midwife walked in the room, and she checked for the nuchal cord. The big cord was so tight that it couldn't be felt. She had to push the baby's head back into my wife and then unwrap the cord and then went ahead and delivered the baby. And then there was a massive power failure in the hospital, and all the power went out in that wing of the hospital for 45 minutes. That's what happened to me. That's what happened to me.
Thank you, Dr. Morse. You are the best.